The Simcha of Adar is related both to the Yontif of Purim and the Yontif of Pesach. Somehow the combination of Purim and Pesach brings out this idea of Simcha. Before I go on, I want to dedicate the Shir Le'ilui Nishmas Naomi Bas Avraham Ephraim Yehuda, who was Naomi Shisha Wiesenberg, who was well known in the community here. Her brother is my neighbor in Moshav Matityahu. In fact, the family is sitting Shiva there in Eretz Yisrael. And I think it's very fitting during the Shiva to dedicate the Shir Le'ilui Nishmas. Before we can discuss what Simcha is, I think first we have to discuss what it's not, what most people think it is. Most people think that Simcha depends on attaining various things, and if you just have those things, you'll be happy. Whether it's a certain amount of money, a certain kind of home, certain attainments in life. And many people think that if they just would have this attainment, that attainment, they just be married, they just have children, they just have a new house, they would just have a better job, they'd be happy. That does not bring a person happiness. In America, we are guaranteed, I don't know if the English are guaranteed that, but we're guaranteed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It doesn't even say you're guaranteed to be happy. It just says you're guaranteed to pursue it. Let me tell you what the pursuit of happiness is like. I was a rabbi in Miami many, many years ago. In Miami, they have something unusual, different than the rest of the world. In many places in the world, they have horse races. In Miami, they had dog races. I never was at one, but they tell me the following. There's a very big difference between dog races and horse races. Horse races, there is a somewhat intelligent human being that rides on the horse and knows that if he wins the race, he gets paid more than if he loses the race. So he gives the horse incentive to run faster. Dogs have nobody riding on them. So how do they give the dogs the incentive to do their best? They don't get them before the race and say, listen, there's a lot of money over here involved. Run your fastest. They don't understand that. What they have is a mechanical rabbit called Speedy that runs ahead of the dogs. And the faster the dogs run, the faster the rabbit goes. Because if they ever catch the rabbit, they'll realize that it's not a rabbit. It's just a doll. And they'd stop racing. That is the pursuit of happiness. You run and run and run and always think that if you'll just get this thing, you'll be happy, and then you get that thing and you find there's more things. In fact, just the opposite. Person has 100, he only wants 200. Once you have 200, you want 400. And you're never happy. Nefesh lo simali. I learned this lesson many years ago. We were having a fundraising to build a new shul. And the board of directors of the shul decided that they would like to have donations of $5,000 over 5 years from all the members of the shul. And at that time, I had members of my shul who were earning about $10,000 a year. This is about 30 years ago, was an average salary. And I had doctors, lawyers who earned $200,000 a year. So I figured I'm not going to go to the people earning $10,000 a year and ask them for a pledge of $5,000 over 5 years. My chances of getting that are very slim. I'll go to the people who have beautiful palatial houses, who are earning $200,000 a year. They'll give it to me out of small change. And after sitting with these people and hearing words I never heard before of cash flow and liquidity, and at the time I finished speaking to them, I really wanted to give them a quarter for a cup of coffee because I felt that they were like really poor people living in these beautiful mansions. So I saw I wasn't getting anywhere with them, even though at the end of the conversation they would tell me, Rabbi, I'm trying to double my income for next year. And if I expand my practice and I'm able to double my income, you will have your pledge. So I figured, I'm not getting anywhere here, let's try the other people. So I went to them, and sure enough, they told me, Rabbi, $5,000 over 5 years, I only earn $10,000 a year. But I'm trying to double my income for next year, and if I can, you have your pledge. Then I realized the first people were $200,000 poor. They needed to double their income to feel happy. And the second people were only $10,000 poor. They only had to double their income to be happy. So who's poorer, right? The $200,000 people were $200,000 poor. These people only $10,000 poor. So attainments and getting things is not necessarily what's going to make you happy. There's always something else. I heard a very good joke that points this out. Somebody worked his life to be able to purchase one of these stretch limousines, long cars, because his boss had one. And he felt that if he could just have that stretch limousine, it would bring him happiness and he would feel that he's made it in life. Finally, he's able to buy this stretch limousine. He wants to show it off to his boss and let him know, I've also made it in life. Goes to his house, not there. Drives around the block. Finally finds him by a red light. And he honks the horn. The window comes down. He says, the boss says to him, what do you want? He said, I want to show you I have a stretch limousine just like you. The boss says, tell me, do you have a bar in your stretch limousine? No. Do you have a pool table? No. Do you have a living room suite? No. He said, what kind of stretch limousine is that? The band is broken. He works another few years and able to put in a bar and a pool and a living room suite in his stretch limousine, and he goes now to find the boss and tell him now he's really made it. Finally finds him again, parked by a red light, honks the horn, nothing. Again, finally gets out of the car, bangs on the window of his boss's stretch limousine, and after a few minutes the window comes down. And the boss says, what do you want? He said, I put a bar, a living room suite, and a pool table in my stretch limousine. I've made it. And the boss says, for that you got me out of the shower? There's always something else. So that is not what happiness is. So what is happiness? There are two Mishnayos in Pirkei Avos that seem to be very contradictory. One Mishnah says, Yofa Shoachas shall Koras Ruach Ba'olam Haba Mikol Chaye Olam Hazeh. 1 second of peripheral pleasure in the world to come is greater than the sum total of all pleasure in this world. This world is nothing compared to the world to come. Peripheral pleasure means the following. There's a banquet being prepared and you're not invited. They won't even let you into the banquet hall to see the food, let alone eat it. The most you can do is walk by the outside of the banquet hall and get a whiff of the aroma of the food that's cooking. That's called peripheral pleasure. 1 second of that kind of pleasure in the world to come is greater than all the pleasure ever experienced in this world, from the beginning of time till the end of time. All the people that ever existed. So that Mishnah makes little, if not, and nothing of this world. Nothing compared to the world to come. There's another Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Says just the opposite. Yofa Shoachas shel tshuvu ma'asim tovim b'olam hazeh mikol chayei olam haba. 1 second of tshuva and ma'asim tovim in this world is greater than the whole world to come. So if we were scholars, academians, we would say that there's two schools of thought amongst the rabbis. One school of thought likes this world, and one school of thought likes the other world. There's the this-worldly rabbi, the other-worldly rabbi. There's only one problem. The same Tana said both of these Mishnayos. And he wasn't schizophrenic, didn't argue with himself. So, what is it? Is this world better than the next world, or next world better than this world? Obviously, the answer is there are qualifications of how you look at this world. Under a certain outlook, this world is nothing compared to the next world. With a different outlook, this world is even better than the next world. What are those conditions? Let me start with a medrash The Medrash says, I'm going to paraphrase the Medrash, if you want to look it up, it's in Koheles Rabbah on the Pasuk Mu'uvas Lo Yuchal Lishkon. There are certain things in this world that are crooked and can never be corrected. And the Medrash gives a story to illustrate that. There were two criminals, two Rishoyim, that were partners in crime their whole life. They robbed, they murdered together as partners. One of them died and he went to Gehenna. And he was suffering in Gehenna for a period of time, doesn't say how long. And one day he looks up and he sees they're escorting the neshama of his partner into Gan Eden. So he calls over the Malach, who was appointed over the neshamas in Gehenna. And he says, there must have been a computer error over here, because that's my partner. When I robbed, he robbed. When I murdered, he murdered. If I belong in Gehenna, so does he. So bring him here to keep me company. And if he belongs in Gan Eden, so do I. Get me out of here. The Malach comes back. He says, there's been no mistake. He belongs there. You belong here. He says, I get it. He bribed somebody. Tell me how much and who, and I will give double. The Malach says, I'm sorry. There is no bribery over here. He says, then tell me. Why is my partner in Gan Eden and I'm in Gehenna? He said, because you don't know what happened after you died. You see, you dropped dead one day in the street and nobody wanted to bury you because you were such a despicable person. And they left your body rot in the street for 3 days. After 3 days, somebody benevolently kicked your body into a hole in the side of the road and that's where you're buried. When your partner saw this, it really made an impression on him. And he started to think, is this the way I want to end up my life? Nobody wants to bury me. I'll be kicked in a hole in the side of the road. And he started to rethink his whole life. And he did tshuva. He repented. And he ended up being a tzaddik gomer. And he died a fully repentant tzaddik. So he's in Gan Eden and you're Gehenna. Just whenever I say this over to women, I have to add the following. Because I'm sure that many of you are thinking that's not fair. Because the first guy didn't have anybody to learn from, and the second guy did. Anybody thinking that? Yeah, okay. I never heard a man ask me that question. Only women. Let me make you feel good. The Medrash is not telling me the entire life story of these two people. It just wants to bring out a point. I will make you feel good that for sure something happened to the first guy that he could have learned from. The Medrash is not telling me that. So he also could have learned. He didn't. The second guy could have ignored this and didn't. So the second guy is in Gan Eden, the first guy is in Gehenna. The guy says, oh, that's great. I thought it was going to cost me money. I'll do tshuva too. You know, if I would have known where I'm going to end up, I never would have done it. I regret it. I'll never do it again. Chotasi, avisi, poshati. Get me out of here. The Malach says, I'm sorry, but it's a little late. Don't you know the world you came from is like Erev Shabbos? The world you're in now is like Shabbos. If you prepare on Erev Shabbos, you have what to eat on Shabbos. You didn't prepare anything before you got here. Now you want to do tshuva? Now you can't cook a meal. It's Friday night. It's too late now. And don't you know, the Malach said, that the world you came from is like the dry land. And the world you're in now is like the sea. If you prepare your boat on the dry land with supplies in the middle of the ocean, you have what to eat. You set sail with an empty boat. Now you're in the middle of the ocean and you want to get supplies. There's no supermarkets here in the middle of the ocean. It's too late now to do tshuva. Now's not the time. You should have done it before you came here. Don't you know, the Malach said, that the world you came from is like the city and the world you're in now is like the desert. If you prepare in the city, you can survive in the desert. You didn't prepare in the city. Now you came into the desert unprepared. Now's not the time for the preparation. And the first person realizes that what he did is incorrectable, and he bemoans his fate. Two questions on this medrash. Firstly, there is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that tells us what this world is compared to the next world. This world is like a preparation room to a castle, a prozdor bifnei ha-olam haba. Prepare yourself in the preparation room so you can go into the castle. Why didn't the Malach tell him a mission in Pirkei Avos? Didn't you know the world you came from is like a preparation room and the world you're in now is like the castle? You didn't prepare yourself. You can't go into the castle. Why did he tell him three mishalim and not the mishnah in Pirkei Avos? One question. Second question. I'm sure the guy got the message after the first mashal. Why did he have to tell him three separate mishalim? One of my balabatim, who happens to be a mechutin of mine now, years ago heard this question that I asked, and he said, Rabbi, it's simple. That's Gehenna, listening to extra long drushes that aren't necessary. But in any case, as a rabbi, I don't agree with that. So why? Why three mishalim? Doesn't seem to be necessary. And why not the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos? There are basically two philosophies, two perspectives on what this world is all about. There's a secular philosophy, which has many manifestations, but it all boils down to the same sentence I once saw on a t-shirt that they were selling in New York, like hotcakes. It had one sentence on it. The sentence said, the one who has the most toys when he dies wins. What does that mean? Toys are things that bring you pleasure. Objects, experiences, whatever it may be. When you're little, the toys are little. When you get bigger, the toys get bigger. And life is, you're born, eventually you leave this world, and whoever amasses the most toys during his lifetime wins, had a successful life. Now, I was looking for an asterisk with a footnote, what exactly you win at that point since you're no longer here. But then I heard of a woman from Los Angeles who, before she died, asked that she be buried not in a coffin but in her Rolls Royce. And they fulfilled her wishes to the chagrin of her heirs, and they buried her in this car. She won. She had the biggest, most expensive toy she got to be buried in. I don't know exactly what it did for her. I'm sure her gas mileage at that time was really great because she wasn't going anywhere. But in any case, she had the biggest toy, and she won. If that's what life is all about, attaining things between the time you're born and the time that you leave this world, then we can describe life in the following very depressing way. And I didn't come here to depress you. This is not our hashkafa on life. But if it is your hashkafa on life, then eventually it's going to hit you that this is what life is all about. Imagine a man standing outside the delivery room, waiting for news of the wife's impending birth. And the doctor comes out and he says, I have very, very sad news for you. Your wife just gave birth to a baby, but the baby was born with a terminal disease that it can't survive. Your baby's going to die of the disease it was born with. The man says to the doctor, give me hope, doctor. There's a cure. No, there is no cure. You're looking for a cure. No, he gave up long ago. Someone survived this terrible disease miraculously. Never. He said, never heard of such a terrible disease. No cure. You're not looking for a cure. No one ever survived it miraculously. What's the name of this terrible disease that my child was born with? He says, you see, when your child was born, he contracted the disease we call life. Some people survived 80 years, 90 years, 100 years. We don't know how long it's going to take. But we know one thing for sure. Whoever contracted the disease called life upon birth eventually died from it. If that's all that life is, the seconds between when you're born and when you die, then as soon as you're born, you begin to die. Imagine if we know how long we're going to live. We're all going to live in Mirtz Hashem 120 happy, healthy years. How many seconds in 120 years? So figure it out. 120, multiply it by 365. That's how many days in 120 years. Multiply that by 24. That's how many hours. Multiply that by 60. That's how many minutes. Multiply that by 60. That's how many seconds. Big number. Put it up in the delivery room, and as soon as you're born, press the button, and the numbers start to go down towards zero. You're sitting here, the numbers are going down. That's what Chazal said. Rishoyim b'chayehem nikroyim mesim. Rishoyim, during their lifetime, are called dead, but I don't think it means that. Mesim can be a noun. They are called dead. They're not dead, but mesim, they're dying. That's what you're born, you begin to die. And that's all that life is. It's a long death. It's a long sickness that eventually you die from. But that is not our hashkafa of life. According to the Torah, life does not start when you're born. We were created as neshamas, and that's what we are. We are neshamas. And we lived as neshamas in a spiritual world for thousands of years before we came into this world. And in that world, we were able to see without eyes and hear without ears and get along without arms and legs. When we came into this physical world like an astronaut. An astronaut is on terra firma, he's on this earth, he can function very nicely without a spacesuit. But when he goes into outer space, which is not compatible to a human being, so he needs a special suit to wear. He needs oxygen to breathe, he needs a pressurized suit, there's no air pressure, and he needs a radio to talk through because there's no sound waves. Comes back to Earth, takes off the suit, he can function very nicely. As long as we were neshamos in a spiritual world, we can function very nicely without any special body. We came into this physical world, we need a body. So we need arms and legs to get around, and we need eyes to see and ears to hear. When we leave this world and go back to the spiritual world, leave the body here, just like the astronaut takes off the suit. It could be for that reason one of the ways we express mourning for someone who died is by tearing our clothing, because it shows that it's only the clothing that's been torn away. The essence of the person still is there. The person didn't change, just his clothing is, he changed clothing. That's all. He left the suit of clothing that he wears in this physical world here. His neshama is the same neshama. And now it's in a spiritual world, doesn't need that clothing anymore. In any case, so why did the Rabban Hashem create us, put us in a spiritual world, then force us to come into this physical world, and then take us back to the spiritual world? Just leave us where we were. What do we need this world altogether? So Chazal tell us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, being the ultimate good, wanted to shower his goodness on a creation that could receive that good. And the ultimate good is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And that's what we call Olam Haba. Tzadikim Yoshvim Va'atroseihem Barosheihem V'nehenem Miziv HaShchina. That is an eternal, intimate, close relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is the ultimate pleasure that a person can have eternally. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have created our neshamos, bonded with them eternally, and give us that Olam Haba. But he knew that if we didn't earn it and deserve it, we wouldn't really appreciate it. So in order for it to be the ultimate good, HaKadosh Baruch Hu put our neshamos in a physical world, in a body, separated from him, and he said, you create the bond with me instead of me creating it with you. And if you'll create it, you'll appreciate it. So he put us in this world, and he gave us the ability to make our neshamas godlike by doing things in this world, everything, what we can do, in a godlike way. How do you know what's godlike? We have a Torah and mitzvahs that give us an example of what a godly way of living is. But it applies to everything in life. How you eat and drink and conduct your married life, your social life, your economic life. Every single thing you do can be done in a way that's more godlike, and then you make your neshama more like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and after 120 years you have a closer relationship with him. Or you do things that are ungodly and your neshama is less like the Rabban Shel Olam, and after 120 years you have less of a relationship with him. So you create it, and it's not just you earn Olam Haba. You create it, because earning it wouldn't be enough. People think that Olam Haba, you get like a Purim carnival. There's games to play. If you win, you get coupons. At the end of the day, you get take your coupons to the prize booth. And if you have a lot of coupons, you get a big bear. And if you have a few coupons, you get a little bear. And that's Olam Haba. After 120 years, they add all the points you have in this world. And they give you a coupon. You go and cash it in for a share in the world to come. It doesn't work like that. That wouldn't be the ultimate pleasure. Give you an example. Imagine if you wanted a very plush, comfortable reclining chair for your birthday, and you were hoping that your Aunt Matilda would give it to you. And sure enough, your birthday comes, and Aunt Matilda comes through with the beautiful reclining chair. You sit in it, you enjoy it. Yes, 100%. What happens though if Aunt Matilda decides to buy you a sweater instead of the chair? Now you don't have your chair. And you don't have enough money to buy it. So you get a job, and you work for a month 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, to earn enough money to buy that chair. And at the end of the month, you go to the store, you buy the chair, and you sit in it. You think you'd appreciate it even more than if you got it for a present? Of course. What happens, though, if you can't buy the chair? So you plant trees and raise them until they are capable of being cut down for lumber. You cut them down and make them into boards and make the frame of the chair. You raise sheep and make the stuffing, shear their wool and make the stuffing of the chair. You mine iron and make nails and bang it all together. You raise cotton, spin it into thread and make the upholstery of the chair. And after you finish making that chair from scratch, you sit in it. You think you'd appreciate it more, of course. So in order for Olam Haba to be fully appreciated, it's not enough just to earn it. You have to create it. And every single thing we do in this world, b'chol drochecho do'ehu, everything a person does, can in either make his neshama more like the Ribbono Shel Olam, or less like the Ribbono Shel Olam. And in that way you create your bond, you create your relationship eternally with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You don't earn it, you create it. Even more than that, those who have the first philosophy of life, that life is a place to enjoy now, here and now, and that's all that life is, there is no second of life that is intrinsically important, because you can't have any pleasure in 1 second. Nothing. Can't eat a steak, can't whatever. What can you do in a second? So you need a lot of seconds for life to be important. The more seconds, the more importance life has, the more pleasure you can have, the more toys you can get. But that's not enough either. Because you can have a long life ahead of you, but if Rahman al-Itzlan, you're in a coma in the hospital, your quality of life is almost nil. And what can you do? What pleasure can you get then? So you need a combination of two factors, quality and quantity. If you have enough time and quality time, then life is important. Otherwise, life isn't important at all, intrinsically. From a Torah standpoint, every second of life on any level is eternally important. Because in 1 second, you can create eternity. The Gemara says there was a famous sinner, Eliezer ben Durdoi, who in the midst of a sin, something happened, and he was intensely moved to do tshuva. And his tshuva was so intense that he died. And a heavenly voice resounded, Ashrecho Reb Elezer ben Durdoi shemesukin l'olam haba. When Reb Yehuda Anossi, Rabbeinu HaKodesh, the compiler of the Mishnah, heard this, Maisa, he cried. And he said, Yesh kol l'olamo b'shachas. You see, a person can acquire his olam haba in 1 second. So the tells the Rosh Yeshiva asked, what was he crying about? He should have been ecstatic. Wow, you can get olam haba in 1 second. Why was he crying? He said, because he realized he could do that every second. There's no limit to how much olam haba, how close you can come to the Ribbono Shel Olam. In mathematics, there is theoretically an infinite amount of whole numbers. You can always add another whole number. But there's also an infinite amount of fractions between every two whole numbers. So in mathematics, there's an infinite amount of infinities. In Olam Haba, there's an infinite amount of eternities. And every second, you can create more and more Olam Haba. And how many seconds do we let slip through our fingers that we create nothing? That's something to cry about. So from a Torah standpoint, every second, no matter what level or quality of life you are, you could be in a coma in the hospital, Rahman al-Itzlan. But you can still think, you're alive. And even if the EEG says flat brain waves, that doesn't mean you're not thinking. That could mean that the machine is not sensitive enough to pick up brain activity. 20 years will make a more sensitive machine and apologize for pulling the plug on you. Or it means that the machine will never pick up brain activity because there is none. But still a person is still alive, his neshama is connected to his body, he's thinking through his neshama. So big deal, so he's thinking. You can think about doing mitzvahs that you can fulfill with thought. You can do tshuva. You can change your whole life in 1 second, even on that level. Even more than that, you can think about doing mitzvahs you can't do, and the rule is if you want to do a mitzvah but you can't do it by circumstances beyond your control, you get rewards if you did it. That person can do every mitzvah in 1 second. So on any level, any amount of time, life is infinitely important from a Torah standpoint. And therefore, if you were to be asked, who values this world more? A religious person who believes that the main thing is the next world, or an irreligious person who doesn't believe in the next world, all he has is this world. On the surface, you would say, of course, the irreligious person values this world more. For the religious person, this world is not so important. We have another world. It's not true. The irreligious person, this world has no intrinsic value. It's only a combination of quality and quantity that makes this world important altogether. But for a religious person, every second of life in this world is infinitely valuable, because here's where you create the world to come. And therefore the Mishnah that says that this world is better than the next world is from a Torah standpoint. Because if you understand that this is the place that you create Olam Haba, it's better than Olam Haba. Because once you get to Olam Haba, you're stuck with what you have. Here you can create every second more and more. From a secular standpoint, the next world is infinitely greater than this world. Because if you're looking for pleasure only in this world, that's your goal. That's the purpose. Then whatever pleasure you can possibly have in this world is nothing compared to the eternal spiritual pleasure of Olam Haba. That's the difference between these two Mishnayos. What is the real hashkafa of this world connects in regards to the next world? The real hashkafa is that this world has no other purpose than to prepare for the world to come. That is the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos. Let's analyze the Mashal. This world's like a preparation room for the world to come. Prepare yourself so you'll go into the world to come. Why do they build preparation rooms? For no other purpose than to prepare to go in the castle. There's no other purpose. It wasn't made for any other purpose. And what do you do there? What is it equipped to do? Only things that prepare to go in the castle. They don't have ping pong tables there. They have hair dryers, combs, whatever you need to prepare to go into the castle. It's not equipped with anything except what you need to prepare to go into the castle. And what do you do there? Only prepare to go to the castle. You don't do anything else. The entire purpose why this world was created, what it is equipped with, what you're supposed to do here is prepare for the next world. That doesn't mean to sit in a corner and say Tillim all day. It's very nice to do that too. But it means every aspect of life, every aspect, everything you come in contact with can be done in a way that creates eternity or the opposite. So everything in this world, everything was created for that purpose. Nothing is for any other purpose. But go tell a Russia who lived his entire life in crime, didn't you know the entire purpose of this world was to prepare for the next world? Of course he didn't know that. He doesn't know it now either, because he's just dead. He didn't become a big philosopher. So therefore the Malach didn't waste his breath to tell him the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. But he said to him, look, you may not have understood that the entire purpose of this world is to create the world to come. Maybe in your mind, this world was like Erev Shabbos, and the next world was like Shabbos. Not the same thing anymore. Erev Shabbos, you eat breakfast, you go to work a little bit for Erev Shabbos. The main purpose of Erev Shabbos is for Shabbos. Maybe that you understood. Not that the total purpose of this world is for the next world, but the main purpose. And even if that you didn't understand. And in your mind, this world was like the dry land and that the next world like the sea. Equal. Nice places. This world's a nice place, that world's a nice place. But you knew that one day your boat was going to set sail. Why didn't you prepare? And even if that you didn't understand. And in your mind, this world was a city, this is the Iker. And the next world was a desert, desolate, meaningless to you. But you knew one day you're going to have to go into that desert. Why didn't you prepare a survival kit? So either you didn't believe, or you didn't care. In either case, you deserve where you're to be. But the real hashkafa is, there is no other purpose in this world. Not anything that a person should do, without knowing that he's doing it in order to create eternity. How you eat, how you drink, how you conduct your married life, your social life, your leisure life can be done in a way that creates eternity or creates nothing. Or the worse than that, even the opposite. If that's the case, we can understand a very difficult Rashi, Chazal. Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev says, Bikesh Yaakov Leishe B'Shalva, Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov wanted to have a little peace and quiet in this world. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo dayin l'tzadikim asher mesukim lahem l'olam habo. It's not enough for tzadikim what I have in the next world. Mevakshim leishe b'shal v'bolam. They want to take it easy in this world. Nothing doing. So everybody asks, why not? Kodesh Baruch Hu can't fargin a tzaddik, a little shalv in this world? He says, not everybody gets both worlds, but not everybody doesn't. Yaakov Avinu couldn't have a little peace and quiet in this world also? Why not? All tzaddikim have to suffer in this world? It's not true. What does it mean? I'll tell you what I think it means. When I was about 8 years old, I remember the supermarket in our neighborhood had a contest. And the first prize of the contest was 15 minutes to go through the supermarket and take off the shelves for free whatever you could. And a woman won this contest, and they invited the whole neighborhood to come and watch her claim her prize. So I went with my brothers, Aleim HaShalom, to see this. 8 years old, it was something to see. I remember the woman was showing off the sneakers that she bought special so she could run fast through the aisles of the supermarket. She had two carts, trolleys, on each arm so she could make sure that she got as much things as she could to put in both of these trolleys. And this was before GPSs. She had a map of the supermarket attached to her head, right in front of her, with the more expensive aisles marked off where they were, so she'd go there first. They told her, lady, we're going to blow a whistle and say, get ready, get set, go. And you're going to start to go. In 15 minutes you have to grab what you can. Whatever you grab in those 15 minutes is yours. At exactly the second, at the end of the 15 minutes, we're going to blow another whistle. If you grab anything after that, it's ours. We'll have to put it back. So they blow the whistle and she starts to run like a meshuggah through this supermarket. Within 5 minutes she was perspiring, breathing heavily. Imagine if somebody would have gone to her and said, lady, you look really tired and out of breath. Here's a chair, have a seat, sit down, take a rest for a few minutes, right? You know what she'd tell them? Are you out of your mind? I have 15 minutes to grab what I can. Now's not the time to sit down and rest. Right, come to me after they blow the second whistle. I'll sit here for the rest of my life. But not now. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Yaakov Avinu. Bikesh Yaakov leishev b'shalva. It wasn't the shalva. It wasn't the peace and quiet. A person can have peace and quiet in this world. But when the peace and quiet induce them to be inactive and just to take it easy and not to put that peace and quiet into the ability to function and to be dynamic, then it's counterproductive. It's like sitting down in the middle of the 15 minutes. So the way to read the Rashi is a little bit different than I read it the first way, which everybody reads it. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not lo dayin l'tzadikim asher mesukim l'olam habo. It's not enough what they have in the world to come. They want to take it easy in this world. That's not the way to read it. The way to read it is the following. It's never enough what a tzaddik already has. And he wants to take it easy in this world? You have 15 minutes to grab. And life, 120 years in this world, is not more than 15 minutes. It goes very, very quickly. You're all young people. So by young people, time goes very, very slowly. I remember when I was in school, every day was a year. Till the bell would ring. But as you get older, every year is a day. And life goes by, look by, just married off my first granddaughter. I remember when I was her age, let alone having granddaughters who were getting married. But in any case, so this world is a long 15 minutes. And you can grab what you can grab. And after that, there's no more chance of grabbing anything. The whistle, now this is not the place to take it easy. This is the place to be dynamic. So the Rabban Shalom said it's counterproductive to let Yaakov Avinu take it easy. I'm going to agitate him. Make sure that he remains dynamic in this world for his benefit. That's what this world is all about. In that respect, we can understand the answer that we give the Chacham at the Seder night. The Chacham asks, Moha Eidos v'achukim v'mishpatim asher tziv v'Hashem lokeinu eschem. What are all these mitzvahs? So the Ibn Ezra says he can't be asking what the mitzvahs are, he wouldn't be too much of a chacham. You know what his question is? Goyim have to keep 7 relatively easy mitzvahs. Not to murder, not to steal, not to curse the Rabban Shem, not to serve idolatry, not to be immoral. And if they keep their 7 mitzvahs, they'll get a share in the world to come. But a Jew has to keep 613, some of them relatively difficult mitzvahs. What did we do wrong that God put this terrible yoke on us and nobody else? Why us? What's the answer we tell him? Avodim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim. Let's look at God's track record. He took us out of Egypt for our sake or for his sake? Obviously for our sake. He took us through the desert for 40 years and provided for our needs, for our sake or for his sake? Obviously for our sake. He gave us Eretz Israel for our sake or his sake? Our sake. So what do you see? Whatever God does, he does for our sake. He gave us all this mitzvahs and Torahs for our sake. It's not a liability. It's not a yoke. It is a opportunity. Israel, Reb Hananya ben Akashya said, God wanted to merit the Jewish people. What does that mean? The word lezakos can mean to merit, it also can mean to purify. The Rabban Shem saw that we have neshamos that have such great potential. We had great avos and imahos. Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Valeya, created within us genetically, spiritual genetics, a neshama that can have the closest relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu eternally. No other neshama, no other nation can have that. They can reach a certain level, but not the level we can reach. But in order to reach that level, you need Torah and mitzvahs. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to purify our neshamas with Torah and mitzvahs because he knew that we have the potential for that and merit us with eternity. It's an opportunity to be able to use our lives in such a way that creates the most intense eternity that can be. And that explains the following pasuk. The pasuk says, Mo Hashem Elokecha Shoel Mimach. V'ato Yisrael. At the end of the 40 years in the desert, Moshe Rabbeinu turns to the Jewish people and he says, what does God want from you already? What does he want from you already? You expect, what would be the end of that sentence? A few measly things. You know how the sentence ends? Mo Hashem Elokecha Shoel Mimach. Ki im only, Le'yiros Hashem Elokecha, Le'avos Olodovka, Vo'leches Bechol Drachov, Lishmor Kol Chukov, Umitzvos, only a million things. Doesn't make sense. The answer is the last two words of the sentence. L'tov loch. It's for your good. God doesn't want anything from you. He wants to bestow upon you tremendous benefit. And that was the mistake the Goyim made, why they didn't get the Torah. When the Ribbono Shel Olam offered the Torah to the nations of the world, they said, what's in it? So the Ribbono Shel Olam said, it says you can't murder to Esav. They said, murder? We have a problem. We live by the sword. How can we have a Torah that says you can't murder? Yishmael said, how can we have a Torah that says you can't steal? Right? We have our hands in everybody's pocket, their hands in our pockets. We can't have a Torah that says you can't steal. So the Rabban Shem left them. Why did he leave them? Why didn't he explain to them? It's no problem. You can live by the sword. That means that you are mercenaries, soldiers of fortune. That's time of war. That's not murder. You can live by the sword and still not murder. You can have yado bakol, the yad kol bol, your hand in everybody's pocket and their hand in your pocket. That doesn't mean you can steal. It means that you, are going to be people that need the whole world for your basic needs, but the whole world's going to need you. So says the Targum. And today we understand that. The whole world needs the Arabs for oil, and they need the whole world for their basic needs. So why didn't the Ribbono Shel Olam explain to them why it's not a problem? Why did he abruptly leave them? So I think an answer to that could be the following. If I had come here tonight and said, look, I hate to do this, but I'm far from home and I really need a favor. Can you do me a favor? Even if you were the most benevolent people in the world, before you responded yes or no, what would you have to say? Huh? What's a favor? What do you want? Maybe I want somebody to carry me home to Eretz Yisrael because I really can't afford the plane trip back. Maybe you can't do that. Maybe I want $1 million interest-free loan for the next 100 years. Maybe you can't do that either. If you can, see me after the shiur. Maybe you can't do that either. So first you'd have to ask, what do you want, before you could say yes or no. But what if I came here tonight with a beautifully gift-wrapped package and said, I heard so much about this program and I'm really impressed. and I want to show you how impressed I am. Here's a present. Would anybody say, what is it? No, you take it graciously. When I turn my back, you look fast to see what it is. Why? Because what difference does it make what it is? It's a present. Take it. When the Rabban Shem offered the Torah to the nations of the world, they assumed he wanted something from them. So they said, we don't know if we can do you a favor and take your Torah. What's in it? The Rabban Shem said, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they're just curious. So he told them something a little difficult for them. And they said, we don't know if we could do you the favor. It's a little difficult for us. The Rabban Shem said, if you think I want favors from you, you're doing me a favor by accepting my Torah, there's nothing to talk about. But when he came to Klal Yisrael, we understood it's a present. So what did we say? Nasa v'nishma, give it. It's a present. They say a joke. The nations of the world said, what's in it? Klal Yisrael said, how much does it cost? The Rabban Shem said, it's free. Free will take 10. It's not so far from the truth. We understood it's a present. It's an opportunity. It's not a liability. And that is what Torah is. There's only one problem. Rashi doesn't agree with me. Because Rashi in the Gemara, in a few places, says the following. He says, the Gemara says the Torah was not given as material physical pleasure. Okay, so it's not considered physical pleasure. Mitzvahs are not considered physical pleasure. Ela, Rashi says, so why was the Torah given? Ela la'ol al tzavareinu. It is a yoke around our neck. Now that doesn't sound like I just told you it's an opportunity, a present. It sounds more like a yoke around our neck. So who's right, me or Rashi? There's another problem. The same Torah that says that you are supposed to serve the Rabban Shem with simcha, and if you don't serve him with simcha, you're going to go into galus. The same Torah says you have to serve God with effort. If you don't put effort into the Torah, you're going to go into galus. They seem to be contradictory. Effort does not seem to be simcha. And simcha doesn't seem to be effort. So are you supposed to serve God with simcha or with effort? The answer is very simple. If somebody gave you a treasure map that told you where you can get millions of dollars worth of precious stones, except the treasure map directs you to a mountain in the Andes where this treasure is buried under 50 feet of solid rock. You have to invest a lot of money to get to the Andes. You have to take a mule up the mountain. By the time you get up there, you see there's no sockets, so you can't use power tools. You got to have your pickaxe and a shovel. And it takes months of hard, back-breaking labor to get to this treasure. And eventually you get the treasure. The person who gave you the treasure map gave you a liability or an opportunity? Obviously an opportunity. Did it involve a tremendous amount of investment and work? Yes. That's Torah. Torah's not easy. And unfortunately, we live in a world where people want it to be easy, where they don't want to put any investment or any work. They just want to have fun. And they want the Torah to be fun and easy and immediate. And that's why we live in a world where people are more interested in schoolas than they are in mitzvahs. Right? Just give money to this tzedakah and everything will be guaranteed fine. Right? Here it's in Eretz Yisrael all the time. It's absurd. No, it's not true. Torah is not so easy. And we educate our children like that too. Sit with my grandchildren, right, and watch Uncle Moshe. Now Uncle Moshe is a very nice guy. I know him personally. But sometimes the message there bothers me very much. Because the message is, it's so much fun to do mitzvahs. Mitzvahs, it's fun to be a mitzvah boy or a mitzvah girl, right? And mitzvahs are so much fun. That lasts till about you're five. Because at five, you say to your mother, Mommy, I want an ice cream cone. And Mommy says, but you just had fleishiks. You got to wait at least an hour, maybe 6 hours, before you can eat an ice cream cone. The kid says, wait a second, Uncle Moshe said Torah is fun. This isn't fun. What kind of Torah is this? And I'll tell you a little secret. There are a lot of things in the Torah that are a lot less fun than waiting an hour for an ice cream cone. So what is it? Is Torah fun or not fun? Not necessarily fun. So what should we tell our children? I'll tell you what we should tell our children. The Israeli orange growers have produced genetically a new orange. And they were asked, why did they have to invest millions of dollars to produce a new orange? What was wrong with the old orange? And they said, people today want things fast and easy. And we have to take into consideration what will please our clientele. So we had to produce a genetically engineered orange, which has a very thin skin, so it can be peeled fast and no pits, so it can be eaten easily. That's what people want with Torah too. Fast and easy. No investment, no difficulty, just we want schoolers. We want right away everything. Schoolers are very nice. They're like the icing on the cake. Once you have the cake, you can put the icing on it. But if you don't have the cake, and all you have is icing, it's very unappetizing. So Torah is not easy. It's not fun. But it's worth it. That's what we have to tell our children. Right? No matter how much investment you have to put in, it's worth it. And we learned this lesson at Har Sinai. When we got the Torah, it was so overwhelming that we died. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu resurrected us. It always bothered me. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew it was going to be so overwhelming that we'd have to die, instead of letting us die and bringing us back to life, wouldn't it have been better if he just gave us the power not to die? Why he let us die and have to resurrect us? Make a smaller nace. Make them not die. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to tell us the following. Torah demands sacrifice. Sometimes you have to sacrifice money, sometimes time, comfort, whatever it may be. And sometimes Jews have been called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice, to sacrifice their lives for Torah. And therefore, sometimes you're going to die for the Torah. But you know what? That same Torah is going to resurrect you and bring you back eternally. So what did you give up? Nothing. You gave up temporal life for eternal life. It's like buying a lottery ticket for $1,000. It's a big investment. But you can win $10 million from that $1,000. And there's only one ticket. Who's going to complain about the $1,000 that they invested to win $10 million? You buy it and you get the $10 million. So the same Torah that you sacrificed for, that Torah gives you eternal life. So what did you give up? Does it involve sacrifice? Yes. Is it worth it? 100%. That's the message that we should give. And that's what simcha is. If you think that things are going to make you happy, you'll never be happy. But if you understand that an attitude in this world of what life is all about and how valuable it is. You know, there's a medrash. We'll end in a second with this. One more mission in Pirkei Avos. The Medrash says, Rabbi Akiva was giving a drasha, and his students began to fall asleep. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years. And he wanted to wake them up. So he said to them the following, Marosa Esther, Shemolcha Almei Avi Esther V'Sheva Medinos. What did Esther see that enabled her to rule over 127 Medinos? Tavo Esther Basbita Shosara, Shechoysa Almei Avi Esther Shana. Let Esther, the great-great-granddaughter of Sarah, who lived 127 years, rule over 127 Medinos. And they all woke up. What in the world is there a connection between the 127 Medinos of Esther and the 127 years of Sarah, except that the fact's the same number? And Rabbi Akiva went on. I think what Rabbi Akiva was saying was the following. Sarah Imenu did not just live 127 years, where 127 years passed over her. But Rashi says there, Chazal say, Shnei Chayi Sora Kulam Shavim Litova. They all were equally for the good. Now that can't mean literally that all of Sora's life was equally good. It wasn't. The 90 years she didn't have a child was not the same as the 37 years she had Yitzchak. The night she was dragged to Paro wasn't equally good with the day they celebrated Yitzchak's bris. So they weren't equally good. But it doesn't say that. It doesn't say they were equally good. It says they were equally for the good. In other words, you can't control the situations that come to you in life. But you can control how you, your attitude towards them, how you use them. How you appreciate the fact that no matter what comes in life, life can create eternity. And if you use it properly, good, bad, and indifferent, you can create eternity. Sarah Imenu, all of her life was used equally for the good. And that's what gave Esther the koach. Esther had a miserable life. Think about it. Want to be Esther Amalka? Taken away from her family. Married to this guy. Her children. Koresh, very nice guy. But he considered himself a goy. So she had a child, right? She didn't go around showing his picture. This is my son, Koresh. Right? Nice guy, but this is what her, when she went to the Beis Yaakov in Shushan, right, this is what she looked forward to have a child who thought he was a goy, to be married to some shikr goy, Achashverish. She looked at that as kasher avadati, avadati. She had a miserable life. How did she have the koach to turn that into something positive? Because she learned from Sara Imenu. Sara Imenu had a difficult life too. But kulam shavim letova, she used every second for eternal good. So Esther was able to do that too. And Rabbi Akiva told his Talmidim, it's not easy to stay up during a drasha. It's hard to fight your eyes closing. But it's not more difficult than what Esther had to go through and what Sara had to go through. And you can be misgaber and you can use these difficult times and make the best of them too. That's simcha. Simcha is being happy with life itself. If you're not going to be happy except with the good things in life that you think are good, you'll never be happy because there'll never be enough good. But if you're happy with life itself, two times a year we have extra simcha. On Sukkot and on Purim. On Sukkot because on Yom Kippur we are understanding that we could lose our lives. And you become happy with just being alive. Once you're happy with being alive and appreciating what life can be, then you can be happy with anything. Then you can have sukkahs. You don't have to pour water, wine on the Mizbeach, you pour water on the Mizbeach. You're happy with the simple things of life because life itself is a present. Being able to live and have a Torah and create eternity, what could you want more than that? And anything you have more than that is hakol revach. It's all benefit. But if you're not happy except if you have those things that you're missing and you think you need, you'll never be happy because you'll always be missing something. The second time is Purim. Purim, we all could have been dead, annihilated. And every year we relive that. So we're happy with just being alive. Some people say that's why you get drunk on Purim. Because drunk is called dead drunk. You know what it means to be dead, then you appreciate being alive. Life itself gives a person simcha, if you're happy with life and what you can accomplish in life. So Purim tells me that you could have been dead. Be happy being alive. And Pesach tells me, now that you're alive, you have freedom. You can choose and make the most of your life. You have that choice. You don't have the choice what the circumstances of your life are. That the Rabban Shem sends you. But you have the choice how to deal with it. Your attitude. You have free choice how to use the situations that the Rabban Shem sends you. Those two things together are the ultimate simcha. I just want to end with a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says, Kachi Darka Shel Torah. You want to know if you're on a Torah path or not? Here is the litmus test. Pas Memelech Tochal, only eat bread and salt. Mayim B'Mesura Tishta, only eat, drink measured out water. Not a lot of water, you have measured out and drink it. Ala Oretz Tishon, sleep on the floor, not on a mattress. V'Chai Tzar Tichya, live a life of privation and suffering. Uve Torah ata amel, that you can busy and involve yourself in Torah. Imata osakein, if you do that, Ashrecha v'tovlach, you are fortunate and it's good for you. Ashrecha ba'olam hazev v'tovlach l'olam haba. You're fortunate in this world, is good for you in the next world. Now, if that's to be taken literally, the only way to be on a Torah path is if you follow that kind of life. I don't know anybody who's on a Torah path. Surely I'm not. I eat more than bread and salt, drink more than water, I sleep in a bed. But even the Gedolim that I knew, all of them slept in beds. I don't know anybody who slept on the floor, except for an old aunt I had who had back trouble. She used to sleep on the floor. She's the only person I ever knew was B'derech HaTorah, I guess. What does it mean? And I understand if you live a life like that, it's good for you in the next world. But Ashrecha Bolo Mazeh, it's good for you in this world. So I think it means something different. What it means is the following. You can eat steak and drink champagne and sleep on the most comfortable mattress. But what would be if you wouldn't have those things, but you would still have life and the ability to involve yourself in Torah and mitzvahs? How would you feel? Would you still feel fortunate? If under those circumstances you could still feel fortunate, then Ashrecha Bolam Hazeh, then you know what life is all about. then your life is not dependent on those luxuries. Those things can enhance your life, but that's not what brings you pleasure and makes you feel fortunate in this world. What makes you feel fortunate in this world is you're alive. And you have the ability to create eternity. That's what you're here for. If you understand that, then you're Bederech HaTorah. If you think that if you don't have those creature comforts, then you can be miserable, then you're unappreciative of what life is all about. Then your life depends on those things, and if they depend on those things, you'll never have enough of them. You'll be miserable all the time. So what makes a person happy, that's a message of Purim. Purim, we could have been gone. We're happy just to be alive. If you can be happy to be alive and understand what life in this world is all about, it's not amassing toys. It's creating eternity. And it's kedai to be alive even if you have nothing else. You're suffering the suffering of Iyuv, but you still can create eternity, and that should make you happy. It may be difficult, and it may be a sacrifice, but it's worth it. That's the message you have to tell yourself. That's the message you have to tell your children. Torah is not easy. It involves investment. It involves hard work. But that's the greatest simcha, because you know it's worth it. Because all the investment and all the sacrifice and all the difficulty creates eternity every second. And that's what we're here for. That's what this whole world is all about. So if you understand that, then there's nothing in this world that can make you unhappy. You're happy all the time. If you don't understand that, there's nothing in this world that can make you happy. And you're unhappy all the time. We have the choice. We can have the attitude that we can be very happy people, or we can have the attitude and make ourselves very unhappy people. It's up to us. That's why the Rabbanu Shem put us in this world. That's why he gave us free choice. And ultimately, it depends on what we want and what choice we make. If we do, then we'll have Marbin B'Simcha, the Simcha of Adar and the Simcha of Nisan. And eventually, a person who serves the Rabbanu Shem B'Simcha will have that eternal Simcha. And the whole world will have that eternal Simcha. B'Vias Goel Tzedek M'Heirav Yameinu.